Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast. I'm your host, Karthik Nachupan. This is the first podcast of 2023. I've been on a break because of my growing commitments at home, but I'm now happy to be back and hope to continue regular programming over the next few months. This episode today features not a book, but a recent edited volume on India. That's called The People of India. It's a brilliant collection of essays from a range of scholars on what constitutes New India, its people, the politics, and how we should understand the current political landscape in India. The editors, Ravinder Kaur and Nayanika Mathur, make it a point to emphasize that the politics of this knowledge production also matters. We need to think through the frames and narratives through which we understand this moment in India, this political moment in India, and offer alternative conceptualizations where needed. The volume also tries to center people that are at the core of this political churn in India and at the core of the recent democratic politics and movements like the farmer protests, by looking at how they form and evolve, the agents that shape that politics. The people in India now are on the move. They form and represent this churn and have always represented the beating heart and soul of the Republic, always desiring, demanding, asking, and expressing themselves in ways that matter. And I think this is what fundamentally pulls scholars and writers to India, to make sense of India in ways that are relevant for our time. I want to end this segment with a quote from the introduction of the volume by the editors that stuck with me since I read it, and I think will stick with you too. It's about the claim, "we the people," which is often used to denote a sense of the collective or the public. But is that all that it represents? The editors push us to think more. And here's the quote. "The familiar claim of we the people, then, at once, is an act of solidarity and emancipation, as well as of exclusion of those seen as external or internal enemies. It is also an assertion of popular will and authentic belonging, a claim often weaponized in times of majoritarian populism to disenfranchise marginal groups and withhold political representation. Far from being stable, then, the idea of the people is always in the making, one that continues to be redefined time and again to promote, expel, or accommodate a variety of interests and groups within its domain. Analysis of politics has to come to terms with this constant churning, even as it has to find new modes to capture that which is most fascinating and perplexing about India, and new old new politics." End quote. Here's Ravinder Kaur and Nayanika Mathur, editors of this brilliant volume, The People of India, New Indian Politics in the 21st Century, published by Penguin. Nayanika, welcome. I'm really happy to speak to you about your new edited volume. I want to just begin by asking, how did this project and volume begin? How long have you been having a discussion about this? And what were some of the initial ideas that led to that?
So the project actually began with a workshop back in 2019 that was very generously hosted by Ravinder in Copenhagen. And that was a workshop, I think, that we had planned for almost a year before it happened. I think sometime in 2018, Ravinder and I started having this conversation on two separate, sort of separate but linked issues. One was this figure of the people that we were seeing a resurgence of, not just in India, but sort of globally, you know, this invocation of the people as the guiding force of a new form of politics. And the other literature that both of us were in conversation with, coming from our own writing as well, was this literature on the state, and how the state has been studied academically in anthropology, in history, political economy, etc. And we've both sort of written on the nation as well as the state form quite extensively. So we basically started having this conversation where we said, what would it mean to put these two discussions, so one, that of the people, and the second discussion of the state, into conversation with one another. And we then thought of this workshop because we were really also interested in thinking about how different disciplines and look at this category of the state and the people. And, you know, and there were some recent books that had come out, some new articles that were coming out at that point. Many of our contributors in this final edited book, who had been writing about these issues, perhaps not as directly in conversation with one another as we sort of hope to make them do in the workshop. So this workshop was held in 2019, and the workshop was called The People's State. And I think 21st century politics or something like that. I can't remember the subtitle. But in the workshop, what happened, it was sort of a 2-day, really intensive, amazing conversation. But by the end of it, I think what we really realized we were really talking about, or what we found most innovative or new from this event, was the discussion of particular kinds of political figures that everybody was talking about in their talks, you know. So everyone was, in one way or the other, actually gesturing to the emergence of new political figures, or they were looking at how certain historical figures were being reformed in this moment, or were being reappropriated, or understood differently, or the legacies were taking on new power. So at the end of this workshop, people we were like, you know, so what do we do? This was also before the 2019 elections, the general elections in India. And as you can imagine, a lot of the conversation, especially between panels and over coffee and at meals, was really about what's going to happen and, you know, how do we see these general elections turning out. I mean, of course, we know the result of that now, but at that time we didn't. And there were some questions at that point about how all of us as academics can comment on the contemporary. How is it that our work can actually speak to this broader question of Indian politics? And so at the end of the workshop, we were like, you know, actually what is most interesting here is this discussion of these kind of figures that are emerging on the political landscape of India. And we also thought that what we wanted to do was not write another very academic edited collection of articles, or, you know, a very sort of straightforward academic work, but rather do what I guess we would call a crossover collection, which is that where our writing would also speak to more popular audiences. And hence the sort of book came into being. And then, you know, of course, we got the contract with Penguin, and we published with Penguin India for that reason. You will also note that the chapters in this are all quite short, they're quite accessible. You know, the academic jargon is kept to an absolute minimum. There's very little referencing and footnoting in it. It's been kept to an absolute minimum.
So I think, thank you so much for asking this, Karthik. I mean, I think one theme which ran through the entire book, which we realized, was the idea of new India or newness. And the forms of the political, or the figures of the political, that we are talking about throughout this book, you know, they have been produced or, you know, amplified in what is called New India, or we thought about as New Indians, and hence New Indian politics. For example, you know, the terms like, or the figures like the politician saint, political activist, political outsider, or the old woman, or even the statue by Kajri Jain. Many of these figures, they have been produced in the landscape of what we call New India. And New India, which we also argue in our book, that newness is nothing fixed. Newness is something which is invented and reinvented over and over again. And this particular edition of newness, and this is Narendra Modi's India from 2014 onwards, that particularly is the focus of the book. So, for example, I'm writing about the figure of the Bhakt, or Nayanika is writing about the figure of Sarkar. What kind of manifestations these figures take, or what kind of political forces underpin that? So I think new Indian politics is what runs through this volume as well.
You know, one thing I was struck, if you look at the table of contents, it has historians, anthropologists, people who study development. There's very few political scientists, if any. How did that affect not just the workshop, but the outputs that came out of the workshop and the thinking behind this new Indian politics that you write about?
I think one thing that we wanted to do was that many of us, of course, have interdisciplinary training, which basically means that we can address the field of politics from a variety of ways. And in this case, focusing on informal politics, the kind of politics which cannot be captured always through quantified, means. And so our focus has been on the informal landscape of politics, or what we may call extra party politics, or the politics which happens in the everyday between elections. Yeah. So often, the focus, political science focus would be on electoral politics. So what we are going into is what happens in between politics as well. So by focusing on the figures of the political, we are drawn to a different phenomena, which of course is tied to electoral politics, but is more, complex, and it is. It is also, for instance, emotional, affective politics, which cannot always be, expressed in terms of profits and losses in elections. So I think this kind of informality is something which can be addressed through deeper ethnographic work or deeper engagement, for example, with structures of language, which politics of love, and devotion, like, how do you even come to terms with it? Like, what about passion, which drives people to vote, which cannot be, accounted for just through social welfare mechanisms or through this entire idea that this is all about economics, right? So there is a different kind of logic which is at stake, which I think we have been able to, or we have attempted to get into.
If I could just add to that, I think in addition to this, I think, of course, this work is in conversation with the kind of broader debates that have been happening within formal political science, or the kind of writing that people who are more straightforwardly within the field of Indian politics have written. But I think it also comes from a slight dissatisfaction with the way in which New India or Indian politics was being discussed in some of the academic literature, where we felt that, firstly, there's a lot of engagement, for instance, with terms like populism, fascism, terms like democratic backsliding, authoritarianism. And these are all, of course, important isms that we must engage with. But we thought that analytically, perhaps something more could be brought to the table by moving away from these theoretical paradigms or these this intellectual apparatus that comes from a discipline like political science, by focusing on other ways of trying to understand Indian politics. So in a way, our claim of new Indian politics is also a methodological claim. It is a methodological claim of finding new ways to understand Indian politics, which go beyond more sort of traditional disciplinary understandings of it. And this applies also to our own disciplines, not just political science, but ours as well, where we argue that we need to find a new language and a new method to understand what is happening in contemporary India.
So let's now get into this new Indian politics. And Rhonda, you started talking about it, so I'll just maybe ask the question openly. So what is this new Indian politics that you talk about? And what makes the politics specifically new?
I think, first of all, we must remember, that the very notion of India as something new is produced again and again. If you go back to 1947, the moment when India gains independence, that was hailed as the arrival of new India. But then again, if you go, you know, go searching the very origins of the term New India, it would straight take you back to the mid-19th century, when New India was hailed, when India became part of the crown. So very few people recall that what is known as the Government of India Act actually was introduced as the New India Bill, which was, you know, a way of introducing India to imperial modernity. Then you come down to 1947, you go on to 1990s, and that too was New India when economic reforms are introduced. So from political freedom, imperial modernity, political freedoms, economic freedoms, and now we are at a point where Narendra Modi's government has once again hailed the arrival of New India. So new is something which continues to be reinvented. And this is one part of the project. What we are also focusing is what kind of new Indians as subjects are produced, political voices, political agents who are carving this new landscape, right? So the point is not to fix and say that this is what newness is about, but to first of all understand the nature, shifting nature logic, or the claim that we are at a new, which is always something which is breaking from the past, right? So new Indian politics that we are talking about is, first of all, the emergence of new political subjects who actively engage in producing the field of newness. And in this case, the figures that we have brought out, we'll try to focus on, and just to say, this is not the sum all of all the, different figures which are emerging. It continues to happen. But our method has been to, enter this field through the people of India. And people, I must mention that this is also a little bit, drawing upon history, because as you recall, the people of India was an ethnographic project of the colonial government. And it was a very different kind of project, which was basically enumerating, indexing of the people, in terms of, ethnicity, in terms of tribes, in terms of caste and whatnot, right? But what we are doing is to look at the political agency of the people. So it's also taking a familiar concept, namely the people of India, and filling it with a different kind of content.
Yeah, and I think we sort of see it as a form of intellectual subversiveness. Mm-hmm. So both the category of New India, which is very, popularly talked about by the current government, as well as the people of India, which was actually these anthropological manuals that had been produced by the colonial state. We take both these categories and we try to sort of re-see them. We try to sort of subvert them a bit through the contributions that these essays bring to both these categories of the people of India, as well as that which we call New India.
So there are three features of this new terrain of Indian politics that are sort of that come alive through these chapters and very accessible short chapters. The first is the primacy of the politics of protest. The second is this push towards hyper-centralization by the Modi government. And the third is this ideological restructuring that centers shifts within a capital religious framework. And I was thinking about these three trends, and I was wondering how are they ordered? Are they ordered in a specific way? Do they work off one another? Do they interact with one another? And I was wondering, and I kept thinking that these have kind of been in India in some way, shape, or form since 1947, right? And this government inherited some of these trends, and they've reinforced and turbocharged some of them. So, how do you look at the historical lineage through which these trends you know, have arrived, but also have been shaped and reshaped in the, over the last 10 years?
If I may begin, I think when I, you know, there is, what is interesting about Indian politics or, you know, contemporary Indian politics is that there is always a precedent that you can go back to and say that, well, it did happen. And often when people speak about, you know, Modi's India, they inevitably go back to 1960s and 70s. And that is the making of Indira Gandhi's, you know, period. And you may have noticed that this is something which happens pretty frequently, that Indira Gandhi is mentioned, you know. So, you know, just to take the phenomena of hyper-centralization that you're mentioning, and indeed, the big conflict which arose during Indira Gandhi's period was, you know, the push towards centralization, which it is also the period which sees a lot of regional frictions, demands for autonomy, you know, ethnic movements, you know, demands which were happening all around the, you know, the peripheral parts of India, if you look at it. And I think what we are also trying to show is that in India, many of the conflicts that you're witnessing today, they are also shaping up, you know, like as you know, more and more push towards centralization takes place under this government. And they are, of course, not the same conflicts as they were in 1980s altogether. Some of them, they may remind you of that, but they are not altogether the same. Because, for instance, the farmers' movement is one key example that we, you know, took off from. And also because we were writing our introduction during the period when the farmers' protests were at its height. And what is interesting was that at this moment, we have somewhat an absence of formal opposition, you know, opposition which is not strong. Often people are talking about the vacuum of opposition. And instead, what is happening is that that space is being taken up by popular protests. So we have had a series of popular protests, which are organized not by political parties, but by civil society groups or, you know, independent people. And we are not sure about their political leanings or where do they come from. For instance, the NTCAA protests, which Nigar has written extensively about. You know, there is farmers' protest, which was mainly, you know, pushed by the farmers' unions and supported by a variety of actors. And so I think this is the way to see that this particular moment is once again, you know, centralization, but at the same time, a response which is coming from extra party politics landscape.
Yeah, and I mean, just to sort of add to that, Ravita's laid it out very comprehensively. You know, I think we were sort of in our passing out of what this category of New India is. We also wanted to once again move away from some of the more standard analyses that have arisen on it, right? Many of them are on, for instance, on the accountability of institutions, on representation by minorities, on particular kinds of more politics in the formal domain, as Ravinder mentioned previously. We also are not trying to argue that this is exactly what New India is, that it can be collapsed into these three characteristics or these three forms. Rather, I think what the attempt here is to try to tease out certain aspects of newness within the historical a point that, you know, this idea of New India is constantly being invoked, constantly being made and remade. But within it, there is something quite specific to this moment. And how do we think about it? What is it that we want to tease out? So as an example, something that we do foreground quite a bit, especially in our introduction, is street politics. It is the protest politics. Now, partly it is because we have both written on, you know, on Ravinder's return farmers protest, I've written on the CANRC protest, but that's not the only reason. We've also foregrounded it because we felt that in other analyses of Indian politics, somehow the power and the importance of this kind of the political was being written out. Whereas what is being foregrounded is this formal domain of politics, and we think that that is actually quite central to New India. And we don't do this in a romantic way, to, you know, romanticize the street or to romanticize the politics of protest or even romanticize Indian democracy, as, you know, many, unfortunately, many people continue to do. But we do it because we think that these are really important moments. These are really important moments. And we cannot understand India today outside what these protests were invoking, the languages they were using, the organizational structures, the power and the passion and the emotion that sort of came across it. And we can't disassociate this from the politics of Hindutva, the politics of late capital, you know, the control of state institutions, the centralization of power, the figure of a populist leader, etc. So we want to put these in the same frame of analysis. And not to say that this is exactly what New India is, but to tease out these different aspects that we think are quite central to this moment.
No, I guess the one thing that I've heard a lot about in the last 5 years about Indian politics is how kind of these mainstream institutions are being hollowed out, whether it's the courts, whether it's the police, whether it's different kinds of formal institutions and agencies. You see that a lot of the commentary is about, and scholarly work is trying to understand how these institutions are being battered, how they're changing, how they're being made to succumb to the will of a powerful leader, right? But you see all these other fissures, openings, which you talk about in the book, which are simultaneously emerging and making up this new frame of politics.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That I think much of the literature has been on this hollowing out of institutions. And I think that is vital, important literature, and we need more research on that. But I think we also collectively think that we can't collapse Indian politics to that process of hollowing out.
So I have one question for each of you, because you've also written chapters in the book. So maybe I'll get to that, and then let's talk about some of the other issues. So first is, I remember your chapter called The Bath, which you referenced briefly. And here there's a really interesting conceptualization and use of the buck to think through how citizens become partisans online, especially, and how they blindly follow the path of the party or the leader through the internet and what they see and hear on the internet. So just broadly, how has technology politicized India over the last 10 years or so and transformed the nature of Indian politics? I know it's a big question.
So I think I have been very drawn to this figure. As you know, it's one of the, like a defining sort of, figure which speaks to, Modi's India, right? So Bhakt is both a figure, that we use it as in a form of, as a joke. It's something that you mock at. It is also something which is worn with pride. So often when you see, Twitter profiles or social media profiles of people, often they, make a tag, proud to be, followed by Narendra Modi, right? So it's a very complex figure, which is both something we mock at and also people wear it as a badge of pride. What drew me to it was to, this effort to understand who are the people who are so proud to be Bhakts, and which basically led me into unpacking the term itself. And what we do find is that Bhakt, at its very bottom, at its very root, it simply means to be a partisan. And the Sanskrit root Bhakt, it comes, something which you divide, something which you distribute. And basically, to love and to be devoted by its very nature is to be a partisan. The point is, how does this, partisan, behavior, how does it connect with politics? So the argument that I'm leading, which I'm, offering, is that what we find in this kind of relationship of love and devotion is that it is not just the leader who's leading the devotees, but actually it is he or she is also being led by the devotees. The relationship is of mutual dependence. And this relationship, like to be a leader among the bhaks, is also to have an affinity and to also actually have a very temporary kind of status, in the sense that this, it is a particular kind of love which can also dislodge you if you stray too far, you know, from that sphere of what we have agreed is our goal. So basically, this is what I'm showing through the chapter, that, you know, the relationship, because I think we do not fully always understand the religion, politics, devotion, you know, like, because it's nothing quantifiable here. Right. But what we, you know, like what I'm tracing is the historical roots of this phenomena. There is nothing new in religion and politics. Like rulers since ancient times have, you know, leveraged devotion and love to consecrate their political power. Right. And in social age of social media, this is, of course, just amplified. And what I'm also laying out is the, you know, the everyday mechanics, you know, how people reach out. Because all of a sudden, Twitter, for instance, has made it possible for you to reach out to your, you know, the loved one, the beloved, right? And what you're doing is to seek out recognition, some sort of affection, you know, and the biggest batch that you can get is to be recognized and to be followed back by the leader. So I think we are aware of this phenomena, but it has created its own life on digital media.
Is it easier to become a leader these days because of all these digital media applications and services online?
I think it is more difficult, I would say, in the sense that you're held to account 24/7 as a leader. There are people who call out to you and say, now you condemn whatever your devotees have done. And then you have to choose to speak out or be silent. And often it is silence, right? Because this is the kind of pact which exists, that in order to be recognized by the leader, you say the most outrageous things, or what we call toxic speech. But at the same time, in order to be accepted in the wider domain, you can, you know, you know that you cannot condemn because you lose out on that love. But at the same time, you also cannot condone it. So this is why we often are met with silence. So I think this is silence in speech. This is what I was focusing on in trying to understand this. I would say it is much more difficult because you can call out and tag your leader and, you know, like retweet 1,000 times.
And I guess the bucks are so many, that there's sort of millions of bucks out there. And you derive faith through, I guess, how you follow the leader.
Yeah. And also, this is not something you can't sit and count how many bhakti. So therefore, it is this very blurred phenomena, you know, that I was trying to enter. Some of them are clearly proud to be followed by, but most are not.
Yeah. So Nanika, the chapter that you've written called Sarkar, which it's connected to some of the past work that you did before, your first book, Paper Tiger, which I haven't read. I was just looking at it the other day, and I hopefully read that someday. You know, and again, it looks like how the Indian state functions, right? And through this chapter, I was kind of struck by our ideas of how the Indian state actually works and how it works. And what you are doing here is you're kind of pushing us to think through not just the state, but about power. Right, how power flows and how power works, not just through the institutions and individuals, but also in other ways, mysterious ways as well. And I kept thinking as I read through it, and I just wonder, and something that I've been thinking about a while about this particular government is that, do they just understand that notion of power better than the previous governments? And they know how to wield it to obtain the outcomes that they want.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Karthik. Let me sort of answer it by thinking a bit more about how I understand the state and what I think Sarkar is, and why we need to center Sarkar in our understanding of New India. So the way I think of Sarkar, as you briefly sort of just mentioned, is really not so much through the formal functioning of institutions as through a focus on the everyday, on the banal, on the quotidian, on particular kinds of bureaucratic processes, on social relations, on individuals, on things, particularly paper, documents, files, and also places. So, you know, places which are then thought of as the site of state power. So if we take this understanding of the state and Sarkar, which is what I've been working with in my first book, Paper Tiger, as well as my more recent work, and we then apply that to this moment in Indian politics, how does it help us understand something that everyone is talking about, which is that the state is becoming a bit more monstrous, it's becoming more demonic, it is wielding power in more authoritarian forms, perhaps, than previously we have seen it do. So, you know, the way I sort of think of it is that the way we can think about it in particular moments is that I'm not sure if this government understands power better as much as it is able and willing to wield it in more, in less processual terms and in more personalized ways.
Yeah.
So I think the way in which Sarkar is becoming, so it was always an embodied institution. So, you know, it would be embodied in DM Saab, or it would be embodied in the commissioner or in the prime minister. You know, again, very famously, Indira Gandhi is, again, a very important example of someone who embodied the state in particular ways and claimed to embody it through her populist politics. But there is something about the embodiment of the state today in figures like Narendra Modi, as well as in someone like Yogi Adityanath in UP, which is something I sort of discuss here, which is quite new, where they the way they sort of say that I am Sarkar, you have this thing called Namo Sarkar, you know, people refer to it as Modi's India. There's a way in which the way in which the Prime Minister or the Chief Minister of UP themselves refer to the state as being embodied by them, but also the ways in which they then come in to stand in for other kinds of processes that are otherwise thought to be a bit more distant or thought to be more, you know, separate from the individual, is something that is quite new. And that is part, but I think that for me, what is most striking about this moment, and you can really see it particularly in the Citizenship Amendment Act and NRC and the National Register for Citizens, in that move, is the way in which there is a canny understanding of the violence of the state being actually compressed in very mundane bureaucratic practices, particularly in paper and documentation, and in law, the everyday formation and the actions of law, and the ways in which this government is willing to exacerbate the violence of paperwork that lies at the very beating heart of the Indian state by either overlooking processes, like overlooking the ways in which normal bureaucratic processes happen, or by creating new processes that actually lead to greater control or power in individuals rather than in institutions or in, you know, or in processes. So in that sense, I would say that I think that, you know, people who are members of the state and, you know, again, having worked with sort of street level bureaucrats, they have a very, very good understanding of state power and how that works. So I think, you know, it is something you sort of develop over time as an agent of the state. So I don't know if they have a better understanding of state power, but I think that they are more willing to say that the state is them, and they're more willing to sort of massage or to work through the sort of supposedly rationalized bureaucratic processes and actually personalize them more, or to oversee or to overlook them, or to just create these brand new processes through which they then will function. Mm-hmm. Now, this argument of mine is linked to the wider understanding of New India, which is that institutions, including highly respected institutions such as the Election Commission of India or the Prime Minister's office, are becoming more centralized. They're becoming slightly less objective or trustworthy than they perhaps were in previous governments. But I'm trying to show it through sort of the domain of the everyday and through very specific examples. And I'm trying to show it through bureaucratic things like paper or like kursis, like, you know, the way in which a particular chair is occupied. So it is linked to that argument, but I think it's a bit different because it's trying to show it in a more lived way. It's trying to show it in a more embodied, in a more impassioned way than perhaps a more, you know, the more normative understanding of the state and and how the state functions.
Yeah, you know, at one point in the chapter, you write about Yogi, and it's really fascinating. You provide how Yogi wields power is that he knows every single police officer, the SPs and the DSPs who operate in the state, and they, I guess, have a direct link to him, and that's how he wields power, right? It just goes to show how incomplete, you know, our thinking about state capacity is, right? I mean, the more we try to quantify it, or we try to come up with measures that are in some way that in some way can connect to how the states function and perform certain tasks, the more we get away from understanding how the state actually works.
That's right, exactly. Okay. And you know, that thing of Yogi actually controlling the police was something that I was talking to a retired bureaucrat from UP, and he said that for him, like I said, so how do you see the differences today versus when you were still in power? And he said the one big difference he sees from the time he was district magistrate in different places in UP is that the chief minister at the time didn't control the police in the way that the chief minister today does. And I think, to be fair to Yogi, he's not just talking about Yogi. This is also happening with previous chief ministers, the ways in, like more recent ones, the ways in which they want to control. And, you know, again, it goes back to the control of violence. You know, it goes back to this personalization of politics in particular individuals, which I would say is not just a hallmark of Yogi or of the BJP in UP, but we can see it in the last decade or more in a shift. But it is a wider shift in the way in which the state functions, the way in which the everyday state functions. I also think that something which is not talked about enough in our understanding of the Indian state today is the civil services and the ways in which the civil services have been compromised, the ways in which, and not been compromised just in terms of the makeup of it or in the ways in which they're being penalized, or the ways in which there's this whole new sort of reign of terror now where, you know, you have to obey your political masters, otherwise you will get punished in postings, or you'll be suspended, or all sorts of things will happen. But I think in the kind of ethical contract that bureaucrats themselves have vis-a-vis their functioning, the ways in which they look at their own roles, or the ways in which they understand their own position within the Indian state, there is a shift in that. And I think that we need more work, we need more intellectual and ethnographic and historical work to understand what's happening to the civil services in India. And sort of the sort of capture of the civil services, this collapse of a particular ethical sense of your work or your contract with India as a particular state or society, the way that's changing is something that we really need more work with, and we need to center more in our understanding of what is new India.
Ravinder, do you want to jump in here? Because I mean, your last book looked at a different aspect of the state, right? And how the state is using branding and different ideas of modern India to generate investment, right? So how does your work add to what Nayanika just mentioned and how we think about the Indian state and how it functions?
I think one thing is, you know, what I in my work would call the logic of branding. And I think just to say that branding is of course misunderstood as something just gimmick or advertising or things like that. But what I mean by branding is actually the process of commodification of resources or commodification or capitalization, you know, of the nation in many ways. So I think here the logic of branding, which I may connect to what Nayanika is saying, is the form of state governance. And by that, I mean the ways in which, you know, the work of the government, which once used to be hidden, you know, there was a certain kind of mystique, that there was a certain kind of secrecy which defined, you know, state, you know, power. But these days, it is the spectacle, you know, or the publicity of the state's work in many ways is what defines or consecrates state power. And for instance, if we just go to Yogi's UP, I think in the last just a month ago or so, you may have witnessed there was a huge, you know, investment summit which was going on. And this was an attempt to first of all, of course, brand UP as an investment destination by bringing in a lot of foreign investors, leaders, to actually replicate this formula, which has been in the making, where you combine a form of, ethno-cultural nationalism, religious identity, together with a very, a global, capital, at home in the world kind of identity. So I think these two things which come together, and each one of them, like all of these activities, are highly publicized. Nearly, I think, every newspapers around the time carried huge advertisements, or, at some point, Economic Times, financial papers especially, they would carry full page supplements of this kind of work which is done. So I think this is what I would call the logic of branding, a certain kind of image framework, a visual state, so to say, which is created within which, this is not necessarily a depiction of reality, but rather something, this image, is like what it ought to be, the dream worlds that I'm talking about in my book, something that, the public, the audience are expected to aspire to. So I think this is where the state power and the ways in which, governance, which comes out of the closet, so to say, and out on the front pages of newspapers and television, actually 24/7.
So you mentioned the workshop for this book happened in 2019. Since then, the world has changed a lot. We've had a pandemic that's really transformed our lives. Have you had a chance to think through these trends, the new politics that you talked about, in light of the pandemic?
Yeah, in a way, I would say one thing which became very clear was that the pandemic, interrupted the popular protests. If you recall the CAA NRC protests which were going on in Delhi, they were called off, or it ended in violence, and that was basically the pandemic became the reason that the bodies were dispersed, right? And that was one thing that popular protests, but at the same time, farmers' protests also happened during the pandemic, and that the state wasn't able to stop, right? So, stop, start, stop. So this has been, pandemic becomes the reason why some bodies can be dispersed or forced to, disassemble. This was also the time, when a sort of emergency situation, the crisis situation is turned into, like a lot of politicians at that time say, let's turn this crisis into an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that basically becomes a framework, the crisis framework, within which some activities can be slowed, as I said, stopped or dispersed. But at the same time, some activities can be, accelerated. And acceleration, for instance, changing, farm laws, labor laws, all of those were brought in just around the time, when the first, height of, pandemic, the first wave, when it went down, I think the summer of 22 onwards. And that was done in light of, that impending scenario that, supply chains from China have been disrupted, that now we need to, bolster this effort to make in India, or Atmanirbhar Bharat, right? So which basically meant that, farm economies were being opened up, or that was the attempt at that point. Likewise, labor laws were tweaked in order to keep labor. As a lot of migrant labor had returned home, and many people were not ready to return. And at that time, there was this attempt to somehow hold on to labor or force labor to stay in particular places, right? It's sort of like, which would remind you of the hukou system in China, the labor system. But of course, it didn't happen because there was some sort of pushback. But the crisis, I would say, that sort of has bolstered the state, this push towards centralization more and more, because it precisely provided a crisis framework within which to slow down some things and to accelerate the others. For instance, the building of the temple in Ayodhya was never stalled. That is something that has continued, and that actually the pandemic became a kind of window through which you could see what are the priorities of the state.
Nanika?
Yeah, I think just to very quickly add a bit would be that I think Satish Deshpande does a very good job in the foreword to talk about what the pandemic has done. And he has sort of an interesting, I think he has particular points on what the pandemic has done to, politics in general, which I will let the readers hopefully read on their own. But I think what I will say from Satish's foreword is that he picks up this question of timeliness, and he says that this book is timely. But then he also says that actually what is interesting is that even as we were, all of us were writing this, or this was being published, the world was changing, right? And so he says that this is important for understanding pre-pandemic politics, but also it helps us understand the shift to post-pandemic politics. So for someone like Satish, the pandemic marks a particular break from the way in which politics has been happening in India. And I think this goes back to the original argument that this book makes, which is that this idea of new India is constantly on the make, right? So even though this, for an academic slash crossover book, this came out quite quickly, we wrote the chapters quite quickly, and it was published quite quickly, it still means that the thing that it's trying to trace, or the terrain of politics that we're trying to chart, is constantly on the make. Right. And this is something that we keep centering in this work, all of us, all the contributors, that we are not at all for a moment saying that this is the way the state is, or this is what the figure of the Bhakt is, or this is what the politician saying forever will be. Rather, we're opening it out to say that, look, in this moment, at with the resources we have to our hands right now, this is what we can analytically claim of this figure or of the politics in this moment. But I do think that the pandemic was really important, and I think in ways that perhaps we have not yet understood. I think there's some ways in which it has been talked about quite straightforwardly as tightening particular forms of authoritarianism, as showing the charismatic hold that certain people have, certain leaders have, because despite the devastation of the second wave, you can see how the BJP came back to power in UP. So it's also sort of strengthened certain understandings of what the political in India is. But I think we still, it's going to take us a long time to actually do that analytical work of understanding what it's done.
So I'm not going to ask you to pick your favorite chapter, because that's not fair. So I'm going to maybe ask it in a different way. What chapter or chapters alarmed you, surprised you, clarified your own views?
Okay, so maybe I can sort of begin. I think for me, I would say that the thing that I learned the most from this, from all the contributors at some level, were the ways in which all the figures that we look at in this book, whether it is Ambedkar or it is Gandhi, or it is, the politician saint, it is we the people, it is the mob, it's the old woman, it's the kisan, it is the peasant, it is the agricultural laborer, etc. What I find really fascinating, and for me was really genuinely a learning, was the ways in which they have particular histories that are being reshaped in this moment. And I think for me, what was really informative is that academic thinking and academic research, which might be, say, that of a historian or that of an anthropologist, can really trace out how in the contemporary or in the current moment, certain kinds of political figures bring a different resonance to them. And so I think for me, I would find it hard to pick a particular chapter or that, surprised me, etc. But I think that for me was a big learning. I think I also found quite a few of them quite chilling, because they show that in this change that we see in this moment, they're bringing more they're bringing more force to them. These figures are assuming particular forms. You know, we've already heard from Ravindra on the figure of the Bhakt and what the Bhakt is in this moment. But I say I'm thinking of the figure of the Karyakarta that Thomas Brumhansen writes about in his chapter, The Political Activist. Or I'm thinking of the politician saint that Gyan Prakash writes about. And, you know, again, the Karyakarta or the saint as a, the politician as a saint are long tropes, are long standing figures in Indian politics. But I think the way in which both Gyan and Thomas show us what these figures mean in this moment is quite chilling. And similarly, so with Nusrat Chaudhary's chapter on the mob, it's again chilling to sort of see what the mob as a political force is across South Asia. I think something I learned a lot from also, which was is Kajri Jain's chapter on the statue, where, you know, she again does this thing of showing how statues actually did have a progressive side to them when she links them to the rise of Dalit Bahujan politics, and particularly in the way Mayawati has sort of marshaled them in service of a particular kind of very important Dalit politics in UP. But then she shows how the statue today, you know, these like tall statues, the size and the height of them, how they're linked to a particular understanding of the Indian state and democracy. I found that very alarming, actually. And again, you know, we know that these very, very big statues, there have been critiques of them and of the money that has been spent on the grandiose ambitions within them, on sort of the very jingoistic politics of the state or the nationalism embedded in it, or the appropriation of particular kinds of historical figures. But I think Kajri Jain really shows you why these statues are so dangerous, so to say.
I think Nirika has sort of laid out the field, but I think each of the chapters actually brings out you know, something which we were familiar with, something which we can see, but nevertheless makes us see in a new light. And I think in this way, you know, the focus, you know, on statues, Kajri Jain's, I thought was quite an interesting thing, because, you know, how should we think about the people of India and to include an inanimate object like statues, which cannot speak for itself? What exactly is their function? What exactly are they speaking? Who are they speaking for? Right? And what do we read? How do we read them? So I think statues, as we all know, you know, the sheer size and scale of the statues is first of all important here, because there's nothing new about statues. And in this case, you know, the kind of, you know, ambition, aspiration, desire, which and anxiety, which goes into the making of the statues and the representation of new India, you know, I think that sort of captures a facet which we would normally not think in terms of the people. So people is also a relation between animate and inanimate in this case, and the kind of work it does in producing the political field. I thought was very important.
I want to end with one final question. In the concluding part of the introduction, you write that this book is, and I quote here, is a modest opening up of a conversation that we hope can be taken forward in the future. I'm wondering if you've thought about how that will happen, especially given how hard it is and how hard it possibly could be to write and research about this new India going ahead. What's your hope there, and how could this happen?
You know, a friend of mine who's also an academic was reading this recently, and she messaged me saying that this precise line that you quoted on how this is a modest opening onto a conversation that we hope can be taken forward in the future, she said that this was the most like gendered writing ever in Indian politics, because normally you have these books in Indian politics where you have men who will be like, this is India, this is India, this is the politics of India, and do not, like, you know, it's certain, it's set in stone, it is authoritative. Whereas I think the tone in our entire book, not just our introduction, but I think, you know, in the introduction, is that we are not at all trying to claim this particular kind of authority over how we understand New India or Indian politics, but we genuinely want to open up a wider conversation on alternative ways through which we can understand, write about, and think about what New India is and how academics can actually comment on the contemporary. And I think that was something that even in our workshop in Copenhagen way back in 2019, this was something that we were all sort of agreed upon. Now, in the second part of your question of how would this happen and how hard is this, I mean, you're absolutely right that it's getting harder and harder for people to do the kind of research that, you know, at one point, I think all the contributors to this volume took for granted, you know, where you're not denied access to research visas or you're not stopped in your tracks, that, you know, you're not actually fearful of writing critically of the ruling establishment. You know, we're hearing all these things about people putting out tweets and they're being arrested for that, or respected academics like Filippo Osella being deported, you know, when they come to India. So there's this whole like sort of culture of fear, which is spreading right now in India, which of course is very well known. But I think the kind of chilling effect this is having or will have on the kind of critical academic political research on India cannot be underestimated. So in a way, again, to go back to one of your previous questions about how things changed and, you know, what is new about New India, I think this is also something that we really need to think about, that are we going to have access to these spaces? Are we going to be able to write in this way? You know, and I don't mean just ethnographic work, but even archives, even interviews, the amount of self-censorship that we're seeing right now in India. You know, I was recently in India and every conversation I had was about how fearful people are, whether these academics or policymakers or journalists, that there is this culture of fear. And it's sort of, and you know, I think maybe like I sort of regret not writing more about this sort of sense of paranoia that you see seeping into, it's not, and it's very legitimate paranoia that you see sort of seeping into every domain of Indian life right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's a despondent way to end, but I guess I would hope that we can still find a way, despite all these restrictions and all these aspects of censorship and these curbs, which we're now seeing across in India, to continue to be able to do the kind of research, to be able to write honestly and frankly, to be able to hold structures of power and political leaders accountable, to be able to speak truth to power.
Ravindra, the last word is yours.
I think the line that you picked up was very nice. And I think, Anonika, your friend's comment is pretty telling because I didn't think about it. But of course, no one in their right mind would think that whatever we are writing, it is the final word on the subject. So in a way, I think maybe more and more academics should adopt, a writer should adopt this approach and acknowledge that what we are doing is, it's a contribution. It's not the final word. I think what my, you know, what I would say is that the sentiment or the you know, ambition that we had with this book was that as scholars, we are able to enter a debate which is contemporary and to say on the subject, you know, which is not restricted to, you know, peer-reviewed journal articles alone. Of course, what we are writing is based on extensive years of, you know, fieldwork, writing. But, you know, like many of the chapters which are written here, they are not something which have been lifted off, you know, from some, you know, they are literally written for in a form. And we must mention our favorite bit, namely what Gyan Prakash told us, you know, when we were brainstorming about making of the book. And he said, we do not necessarily need to have those footnotes, shootnotes. So that became our guiding principle in a way, to be able to write something which speaks to the present, to the contemporary, to be able to speak, you know, in a language which is accessible, you know, and to make a contribution and not necessarily, it's so we have tried our very best to be jargon free, to not take it for granted that the whole world understands what is effective politics, for instance, or, you know, to break down, to make it accessible beyond the academy. So I think I concur with what Nayanika has already put forward. But nevertheless, I would say that my hope would be that we continue engaging with the political to the extent that we can.
Nanika, Ravindra, thank you so much.
Karthik, thank you so much for taking out.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us here and for your close reading of the book. We really appreciate it.
And that was Ravinder Kaur and Nayanika Mathur, editors of the volume The People of India, New Indian Politics in the 21st Century. I'm Karthik Nachupan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.